Welcome to the Evolution Eats podcast. My name is Noah, and with me as always is...
Emily. How are you today?
Lovely.
So today we're going to dig in a little bit more to the Eat Lancet report we discussed in detail before in our Sustainable Diets episode. Since it's been released, there has been a lot of controversy over it and differing opinions from different people. And so we're going to explore those opinions.
Hopefully we'll be able to address not so much both sides of the issue, but multiple what we see as correct viewpoints around the same sort of situation, the same problems that were actually being addressed originally in the report are being addressed in different lights or from different perspectives by what we think are very authoritative and quite scientific bodies of inquiry. So we'll hear from people who are actively engaged in the industry, from professors, from professionals who absolutely are qualified to speak on this and have their own opinions or have opinions that they'll share with us from institutions they may be a part of.
Okay, yeah. So let's start out with an article written in April 2019. This article was written by the American Academy of Family Physicians, and they say... The Eat Lancet recommendations have value, but are they feasible? In particular, it was written by a physician who starts off the article by saying, I've wondered what the physician's role in combating climate change looks like.
It would seem that looking at an environmental perspective on this, how we generate food, how we create food in today's world, doesn't really expand much farther in most people's perception than the farm or than the grocery store. But in discussing how food enters our system, our culture, we also should be addressing, and we think the AAFP is also addressing, how food impacts people's lives and their health after it's purchased and in the act of eating it and living with it. There are potentially quite impactful downstream implications of everything from health to healthcare expenses to transportation costs, deforestation issues, and all of these will come into play from various bodies. But it's clear the AAFP is really concerned with how certain diets or how certain practices in agriculture affect people's health. It's a group of more than 130,000 practicing physicians and people in medicine. So it's pretty important for a group like that to be paying attention to what happens in the American diet and in global food practice.
So they bring up in this article, which we will touch on later, that the report has been criticized by animal agriculture lobbyists. So that's one main criticism of it. But according to this doctor, she says that she doesn't disagree with decreasing meat, because she agrees the scientific community that decreased red meat production and consumption could help to mitigate the effects of climate change. And she goes on to say how she agrees that, you know, it's more than the methane. A lot of the industrial agriculture practices that we use currently are unsustainable. She generally agrees with it in many ways. She acknowledges that animal protein is a crucial source of nutrition in like resource scarce areas and vulnerable populations, and notably the diet does acknowledge that. She says that the greatest weakness of the diet, the planetary health diet, according to the Eat Lancet report, is its prescriptive nature and the fact that it's seemingly devoid of underrepresented voices.
So what does that actually mean in layman's terms, the prescriptive nature of the report? What seems to be happening here is that the report's authors, in the view of the AAFP, are attempting to create what is to be seen as a plan, a diet, a prescription of sorts, a directive that should then be followed more or less by anyone who has the ability to read the report. And it could be seen as not necessarily the right prescription for everyone.
Yeah, that's a good description. And actually, that would lead me to another report that was recently published. in collaboration. It's a collaboration between the Friedman School of Nutrition and the International Food Policy Research Institute in DC, and they focus on the affordability of the diet across different populations. So that's really interesting. We'll get to that in a second. But I think part of the reason that they published that report is along the similar vein, where they're questioning like the broadness and like the prescriptivist nature of this recommendation that everyone in the world, you know, should follow this. And I think just in general, I think in public health, when you look at public health compared to medicine, that's an issue, because the whole field of public health is focused on these broad strokes, these broad recommendations. How can we help the most people? And medicine is really about the individual person. And I think that that's a clash that happens relatively often in general between the field of public health and the field of medicine. But that is sort of the difference in the fields. I mean, we do need these public health recommendations. We do need to try to figure out what is the best way for the most people to stay healthy. And but at the same time, you know, we can't take those public health recommendations as, you know, the truth. And we really do need to have individual doctors looking at each person's diet. And so I think, right, from her perspective, it makes a lot of sense that we don't want to just, like, blanketly recommend this diet to all of her patients. She doesn't want to recommend the diet to all of her patients. And so, yeah, then she goes on to say a little bit more about, like, what she means by prescriptive nature, which is kind of what Noah did say, that she does think that this diet would generally be beneficial for most people, but it doesn't really acknowledge the barriers that certain people would face in implementing these dietary changes. And that really leads me to this other article that I mentioned before called The Affordability of the Eat Lancet Reference Diet, a Global Analysis, which was published in the Lancet Global Health in November recently. And it looks at, as it says, and as I mentioned, the affordability of this diet across different populations.
So what seems like a natural question to ask at this stage is there any location on Earth where vegetables and fruits are more expensive than meat products? Is it ever actually more challenging to acquire nutrition from vegetables in a monetary sense? Because I understand that there could be plenty of situations where meat is simpler in a cultural or perhaps volumetric way, and that it's simpler to acquire more of a given nutrient from meat faster than certain vegetables. That's a common critique of vegetarianism and veganism. But is there anywhere where it's actually much, much cheaper to acquire meat instead?
So I think this part of the report might get at your question, Noah. It says that measuring the affordability relative to alternative sources of essential nutrients, the Eat Lancet reference diet is more expensive by a factor of 1.6. The main cost differences between the Eat Lancet reference diet and the cost of nutrient adequacy largely originate from the larger quantity of animal source foods in the Eat Lancet reference diet than would be required for nutrient adequacy alone.
And in layman's terms, what we could learn from this would essentially be that the piece of the Eat Lancet diet that contains meat and animal products is actually what contributes to the higher cost of this reference diet than in comparison to a standard diet that just covers nutritional bases. So it would be possible to reduce that cost by reducing the inclusion of the animal products. And what I was able to find separately while we did research for this episode was that for the average person, certainly in America or in North America, they're going to probably be able to save around 40% of their average monthly food expenditure by eliminating meat entirely and switching their main protein sources or switching their main animal nutrient sources to something that is vegetarian or at least not directly animal protein based.
That's great, Noah. Where did you find that information?
That information came from a 2012 study that was then republished around 2015, 2017, and made news headlines at that time, talking about economical and healthy diets. It was originally published.
It's in the Journal of Hunger and Environmental Nutrition, is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. So the other thing that was, so that's, we're talking about the US there, and that's a very valid point. But the other thing that this particular study found, the one by the Tufts professors and IFPRI, is that there's a very nice map here, is that the Eat Lancet diet, or called the Planetary Health Diet by many people, is unaffordable for 1.58 billion people, mostly in South Asia and Africa, because they just, but they, but we don't really know if that's just because a regular diet is inadequate for these people. So there's this interesting map that shows the proportion of people whose daily income is less than the local cost of the Eat Lancet diet. So as I'm saying, you know, yeah, it's like, it's horrible that it's unaffordable for 1.58 billion people in these developing countries. So in sub-Saharan Africa, 57% of the population, and in South Asia, 38% of the population can't afford to eat this Eat Lancet diet. But in North America, for example, kind of tying it back to what Noah was saying, only 1.2% of people can't afford to consume the Eat Lancet diet based on their daily income. And in Europe and Central Asia, it's 1.7%. So the developed countries really have, I think, a role to play here, because we do have, on average, the privilege, the economic ability to follow this diet in terms of reducing, you know, this plant-based diet, and so therefore reduce our animal consumption.
Absolutely. So in the developed world, what's happening is that people are simply choosing not to consume food from better sources. They clearly have the resources to choose what kind of food they're getting, and likely for reasons of access, reasons of cost in certain situations, or reasons of lack of knowledge, they are choosing not to eat in a way that is consistent with the report. Now, in developing situations, in developing countries, it's much more likely that they lack the financial resources or simply material or logistical resources to acquire nutrient adequacy, to actually get what's necessary to eat in general. So it would be important, first of all, to make sure people in those locations have access to food, of course, and many organizations are working on that, many nations as well, but in the sense that the objective they're working for could be perhaps something laid out in the Lancet report. That's really an unknown, because in these situations, it's already hard enough just to acquire nutrient adequacy, to acquire the food that one needs to survive.
So let's just switch gears a little bit. I think I mentioned I'm a PhD student at UC Davis. So I ran across this professor, I came across this professor who is at UC Davis, who is in the Department of Animal Science and also is an air quality extension specialist, who has an opinion on the diet, that the Eat Lancet diet, that is not so favorable. He says that these broad recommendations, and especially the environmental claims that the Lancet report is making about eating less meat, eating a plant-based diet, is really not really accurate. And he says that it doesn't come close to the impact of burning fossil fuels in particular, and that the science behind the environmental claims is not very thoroughly researched. He even found a quote, or even asked the science director of the Eat Lancet Commission, and on his UC Davis affiliated blog, he has a quote from this guy who says that the commission, the limits, the meat consumption limits proposed by the Eat Lancet Commission were not set due to environmental considerations, but were actually mostly in terms of health considerations. So the dietary guidelines were initially set to be focusing on health and then secondarily looking at environmental impact. that's an interesting point, although, and if you could get the entire population to eat a healthier diet, that would reduce costs in terms of our health care. I think that's been, would need a citation on that, but I mean, the Eat Lancet Commission is definitely composed of a lot of public health professionals and medical doctors, so it does make sense that their first priority might be the health recommendations. What do you sort of see a do you see an issue with this, Noah?
One of the great takeaways here is that it's quite obvious we're going to see down chain, long-term side effects, whether they're good or bad, from changing one's diet, from changing the food that's coming out of the ground and being grown all over the planet. So it's completely correct to say that there are large-scale, environmental, regional, social, civil, economic, and health-related expenses that will go into not following the Eat Lancet report's guidelines. So, if you were to be a critic, let's say, or at least slightly critical of those guidelines, like this professor seems to be, the leg he's standing on is not necessarily wrong either. And he's saying that there are larger sources of contributing greenhouse gas emissions than agriculture. The problem is that those activities are part and parcel of a larger relationship with food and farming that our planet has. Everything is tied together. So the transportation of food contributes to transportation-related greenhouse gases. And it's a bit disingenuous to suggest that we should then take that to the extreme and not change our eating habits simply because it has less impact than, say, changing the mode of transport that we use.
So I think you had an EPA report up at some point that was showing that, I mean, he's not wrong, this professor is not wrong, that at least according to the EPA, agriculture is only contributes 9% to greenhouse gas emissions, I guess. And that's an interesting, I mean, yeah, 9% is 9%, but what we're trying to say is that everybody eats every single day, and so it's really an easy change to make on a personal level. And so, if everybody made that, I mean, sure, transportation also is. We are totally not. We love, especially Noah loves electric cars, and we really support walking, biking, public transit. I mean, that's another huge way that people can make an impact on a personal level. So, did you have the report up?
I do have the report up, and it's true. Agriculture and food production make up just 9% of US emissions. This is a report from 2017 where the EPA went into depth and was able to glean, hopefully with some accuracy, exactly what percent of greenhouse gas emissions came from commercial residential sources, industry, electricity generation, that is, power generation, transportation, and agriculture. So, with the pie divided that way, industry, electricity generation, transportation, each are roughly a third, with commercial residential usage as well as agriculture making up that sort of rough unaccounted for, ooh, let's say quarter instead of third. So, in this way, I think we are missing a bit the forest for the trees, pardon the pun here, because it's becoming rather myopic just to view this as agricultural emissions occur solely from agricultural sources and then they stop. Well, once you get down chain, once you talk about how the food that we're harvesting, how the food that we're getting from farms gets to people and then impacts the environment and the overall planetary biosphere, that is absolutely going to be something that is involved in commercial and residential cooking, in transportation. The food has to get somewhere. The food has to get to the store and then get to someone's home or business. And then in industry, a lot of that might be tied up in food packaging or food redistribution, food management, and food waste management. So we strongly believe that you can impact more than just one sector of this pie chart here by changing food habits. And your impact could be much more profound both on personal health and global health, than might be suggested.
We're trying to use food and agriculture as sort of a leverage, like a starting point for changing your lifestyle, making your lifestyle more sustainable, and contributing to a more sustainable world. Transportation also is a good way that you can make a personal change. I just like to comment that this professor you've been talking about, I mean, his research, I mean, while he's what he's saying is true, and we disagree in some ways, but his research is focused on establishing environmentally benign livestock systems. So, I mean, he really does believe in sustainable agriculture. I mean, his research is literally dedicated to it.
He's also out of a job if there's no livestock to manage.
That's true. But I mean, I think he does care about making the agriculture, I mean, giving him the benefit of the doubt. I think he cares about making the agriculture more, the livestock systems more sustainable. But right now, like in our current system with with industrialized farming and industrialized agriculture, I mean, there is a lot of evidence that right now it's not sustainable. So even if he's trying to do a lot of work here, I think still making a personal choice to eat less meat is most sustainable in terms of what you can do on a personal level.
Going back to a point that I made a few minutes ago, and to properly credit, I think, the ideas that this professor is presenting, there's absolutely no reason that we can't sustainably farm animals and sustainably acquire animal protein, animal products in the modern world. The reality is that we aren't. So by us suggesting that the Lancet diet is something worth following, I think that's an overall holistic guideline that admits we live in a country where a very small percentage of the food is responsibly produced. And one could have a much greater impact by dramatically changing the kind of food they're actually acquiring instead of just changing the quality. It's very challenging in some respects to get food from better sources, but almost everyone has access to a plant-based diet.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Noah. Another thing, we recently, not recently, maybe a year ago, we came across Project Drawdown. Project Drawdown is switching gears a little, but I'll circle back. It's a research organization, nonprofit, founded in 2014 by Paul Hawken, and he aimed to measure and model the most substantive solutions to stop global warming and to communicate these findings to the world. That's his mission statement in history. And if you look, collected a lot of data and sort of ranked the solutions that he found based on lots of rigorous evidence would result in the most significant atmospheric CO2 reduction. And you have, of the top five, you have two that are very, very directly related to food. And, you know, a lot of the other ones are indirectly related to food. Like, number one is refrigerant management, which is obviously very related to how food is stored and transported. But number three is reduced food waste, which we're very passionate about. We'll probably talk a lot more about later, but right now I wanted to take a look at number four, which is plant-rich diet. And so I find it really interesting that the EPA says that 9%, that agriculture is only 9% of the overall greenhouse gas emissions. And according to this Project Drawdown, this nonprofit, he, with all his research and all of the scientists that worked on this, he actually found that a plant-rich diet was the number four contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. And, well, I guess it's CO2 in this case. You know, there's some potential differences for sure about how it was calculated, but I'm not saying either of them are wrong. I'm just saying how they were calculated is probably different. And this really begs the question, like, how should this kind of thing be calculated? I mean, obviously they're both sort of projections, but how far should we, go out in terms of assessing the impact of food and agriculture on other things?
Certainly, and you all can check this research out at drawdown.org, but what we've seen from this is it certainly seems the drawdown research and drawdown data was gathered with an attempt to look at downchain effects and impacts. So they're definitely going to be talking about how the refrigeration and transportation and management of food at all stages of the production cycle contribute to greenhouse gas emissions. And yes, looking at CO2 is a great way to start looking at that. We, of course, acknowledge there are other atmospheric pollutants that contribute a large amount. And certainly in terms of agriculture, methane from cows is a major source. So that's
even without the methane from cows, it's amazing how high plant-based diets fall on his list, and food waste too. So many of the solutions are related to food.
Precisely. And even again, deforestation to acquire more pasture land or farmland is a huge increase factor for carbon. Once you cut down huge forests, there's no way that that same area of land can sequester as much carbon as the large trees once did.
Yeah, and I guess this goes back a little bit to the Eat Lancet diet in general and kind of what I was saying about refrigerant management, but Noah and I had talked about this earlier. I think it's interesting because transportation is a huge thing. Like, how do you transport food from one part of the country to another? Well, you need to refrigerate the food, and you need to transport the food. And that, in of itself, requires so much energy. And, you know, most of it is now coming from fossil fuels. So we are definitely a supporter of, like, the local food movement into that. And I think that that's a really good thing you can do, like just going to farmers markets and making seeing that the things that you buy were produced locally. But then sort of to bring it back to the, like, Eat Lancet diet in general, like, if we transported everything through, like, electric vehicles, or we had refrigeration systems that were powered by renewable energy, then, you know, maybe eating a plant-based diet wouldn't have as much of an impact on the environment or in reducing global warming. But the way the system is now, it does, you know, and it doesn't mean we don't think we should do. Definitely we should invest in energy and transportation. That's a huge component of this, of the global warming puzzle.
And there are lots of researchers working on refrigerant management and all of these renewable technologies, and that's amazing, and I want to be part of that.
Here's what's really wild. It's that the deforestation that we would prevent by eating more sustainable food is in fact more of a protective instrument for our climate, is more impactful at reducing greenhouse gas emissions than changing the overall landscape of what we actually eat. So if we ate the exact same food farmed in the exact same way but didn't continue to deforest, we would literally actually be contributing less to, or rather contributing more to protecting the environment than if we did nothing. And that's already pretty intriguing. It's almost double the effect. Deforestation is almost double the effect of changing the entire diet to be more plant-based.
So yeah, we're definitely not saying that plant-based diet is the solution to climate change or global warming. I mean, it's one small thing, and we'll see. I'm really interested by the fact that it says on Project Drawdown that the total atmospheric CO2 reduction is a little bit lower for tropical forests than it is for a plant-based diet. But I guess just saying atmospheric CO2 emits a lot of other environmental impacts and other atmospheric gases.
Precisely.
But tropical forests like the Amazon is number 5 on Project Drawdown's list. So that's where you're getting that information from, right?
No, from actual number 4.
Oh, from number 4.
Yep. Protecting forests is an enormous part of protecting our environment.
So to sum up, I think there's some really interesting critiques and reviews of the Eat Lancet report. Some of them perhaps more valid than others.
We found from the perspective of a doctor that perhaps the Lancet recommendations were too prescriptive and too broad. She didn't disagree, but that we would need to sort of make them more specific for individual people. We found from the Lancet Global Health report that looking at the affordability of the diet, that in developed countries, it's much more affordable to the majority of the population. It is definitely affordable to the majority of the population, nearly 99% in both the United States and or North America and Europe. And we have some opposition to the idea of it being so plant-based from people that are interested in sustainable livestock production and sustainable, making agriculture more sustainable and not completely getting rid of meat.
At this point, I would just like to plug an article written by Darish Mozafarian, the dean of the Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy at Tufts University. I'll attach the link in the description, but it's a really good article if you're wondering, should you avoid meat for good health? And should you avoid meat to protect the environment? It's really well done and really separates facts from fiction.
And also some opposition about the fact that agriculture by itself is only a small piece of the puzzle and can't really, you know, it's not the main factor that's driving climate change. But we think it's a very important piece and it's a very important place to start. And there's also further reaching implications than many people realize. And I think the way that you calculate the impact of food and climate change can vary significantly.
Thank you for listening, everyone. This has been Evolution Eats. We'll have links to all the content we discussed attached to this episode and on our main website.